So, well, I know it's a very diverse audience, so what I thought I'd do is go a little low-key tonight, talk about the Chaos Game. How many people are familiar with the Chaos Game? Okay, that's more than usual. I apologize. Those of you who do know the Chaos Game, I command you not to tell the person next to you what's going to happen when you play the Chaos Game, okay? Actually, this is, Ivar's mentioned that we do a lot of work with high school kids. We run math field days at my university two or three times a year, where a bunch of people come up and give actual talks on contemporary mathematics that's accessible to high school students. And so that's what I thought I'd do today. This is actually the talk that I give to the high school students when they come. So, the Chaos Game. If you haven't seen the Chaos Game, it's kind of interesting. Here it is. What you do is you start with 3 points, corners of a triangle, red point, green point, and a blue point. Now, it's an iterative game, so you need a place to start. So put a point someplace, doesn't matter where, let's say right there. And now it's a random game. So what I do is I take a die, a six-sided die, I put it over here. I color two of the sides red, two of the sides green, and two of the sides blue. And then I roll the die. Let's do that. Is that me? No. Yeah, the die plays music. Or it calls me when I roll the wrong thing. So I roll green. So what I do is I move that point half the distance to the green vertex. Now here's the problem. How many people know what half means? It's not half. Yeah, about in half, whatever. Half is going to come up all the time. I can't say it any other way. In any event, then we do it again. Roll red, move halfway to red. Roll blue, halfway to blue. Blue again, halfway to blue. I do this 10 or a dozen times, and then I start recording where that point moves. So roll green, halfway to green. Roll red, halfway to red. I keep the previous points. Roll red again, halfway to red, blue, and so forth. And I do this a couple hundred thousand times, and that's the end of the lecture. Okay? The question is, what's the pattern that's going to result when you play this game? Now, if you haven't seen it before, you say, well, it's a random game. Maybe the dots will fill the entire triangle. Or some people think the dots will be a blob in the middle. Most people aren't prepared for what's actually going to happen. So let me speed it up by rolling 10 times. 10 more times, 10 more times, 50 times, 50 more times, and you see we're getting a pattern, right? There seems to be a big white region in the middle here, another white region here, here, and one up there. We're not filling up the entire triangle. Okay? Let me roll the die 10,000 times, meanwhile making the dots smaller so you can see the pattern, and when I do, you get a surprise. Out comes probably the most famous fractal of them all. Well, I should say the second most famous fractal of them all, the so-called Sierpinski triangle. Okay, so already two surprises. When you're playing this random game, you don't get a random mess. You get a distinct geometric image. And secondly, it's a fractal. I'll explain what I mean by a fractal in a minute, but first, let me just show you why this happens. Why do we get the Sierpinski triangle? Well, suppose I had started with a point right there. That was my initial point. Why is there no point there in the Sierpinski triangle? Well, remember, I erased the first 10 or 12 points when I rolled the die, so I would have erased that point. But watch what happens. I roll green, move halfway to green, and this point has moved from the largest white vacant triangle to the next smallest white vacant triangle. Had I rolled red, again, to the next smallest white vacant triangle, or same thing with blue. And then roll again. Roll red, halfway to red, I end up at the next smaller sized white vacant triangle. Roll blue, halfway to blue, again, the next smaller sized white vacant triangle. Each time I roll, I move into a smaller and smaller white vacant triangle. Roll blue, into another smaller triangle. After about 10 or 12 rolls, I'm inside a triangle that's so small that you can't see it because of the resolution of the computer. I basically then start bouncing randomly around this shape known as the Sierpinski triangle. Okay, now I said that this was a fractal. What do I mean by a fractal? Well, there's all sorts of definitions of fractals, but probably the most important property of a fractal is that it's a self-similar set. Okay, there's other elements like fractal dimension. Okay, this fractal has dimension, I forget, 1.53 or something like that. There's a notion of fractal or fractional dimension that explains the depth of the intricacy of these things. But basically, a fractal is always a self-similar set. What do I mean by that? Well, if you look at that region in the Sierpinski triangle, you see a small copy, a small exact copy of the Sierpinski triangle. And if I zoom in on that region, again, an even smaller copy of the Sierpinski triangle. If I zoom in that very small area down there, again, you see the exact same thing. The more I zoom, the more I get the exact same structure. Let me show you that by magnifying around that region there. Okay, and what you see is the more I zoom, the more you see the exact same thing. That's self-similarity. That's the hallmark of these objects known as fractals. Now I'm going to let this run for the next 45 minutes. Okay, don't worry about it. You'll all have triangular eyeballs, but you'll all be mathematicians, right? The point is, the more you zoom, you always see the exact same structure. Things are slowing down for some reason when I zoom. It should be done by now, but oh well, maybe I will go for 45 minutes. Yeah, we're done. Okay, well, now let me go live and show you a few more of these chaos games. Here's a little applet up on the web called Fractalina, done by a couple of students of mine a number of years ago. Again, I started with 3 points, corners of a triangle, and when I start rolling the die, out comes, again, the Sierpinski triangle. Now, there was no need to put these points at the corners of an isosceles triangle. I could have put them at the corners of a right triangle. And when I play this chaos game, again, a Sierpinski right triangle. And no matter where I put this third point, as long as they're at the corners of a triangle, when I play this game, out comes a Sierpinski triangle. Now, here's the third surprise and the basis for all of the applications of this that I'll talk about a little bit later. When you look at the output of a chaos game, you can go backwards. As long as you have a keen eye for geometry, you can read off the rules of the chaos game that I played to produce that image. Because look at this Sierpinski triangle. The way I've colored it, it basically has three self-similar pieces, three of the largest self-similar pieces, okay, exact same as the number of vertices. And each of these self-similar pieces is exactly one-half the size of the whole Sierpinski triangle, one-half in terms of height, one-half in terms of width. And that was the second number I used, move half the distance to the appropriate vertex. So, with a keen eye for geometry, you can read off these rules. Let me do a couple more. Let's now move to, well, no, let's go to the this one. Here I've put down 6 points, corners of a hexagon, okay? But I've changed what I call the compression ratio here to 3. What that means is if I were here and I rolled the red vertex, I wouldn't move half the distance as I did in the previous case. Rather, I'd compress the distance by a factor of 3. I'd move that point so that the resulting distance to the red vertex was 1/3 the original distance. If I were way up here and called black, wouldn't move halfway, I'd move so that the resulting distance is 1/3 the original distance. That's the compression ratio. So let's play this chaos game. And when I do, you get the same 3 surprises. Not a random mess, a distinct geometric image. Again, a fractal. This is the Sierpinski hexagon. And again, you can go backwards. Just by looking at the Sierpinski hexagon, you know the rules that I used. You see 6 large, self-similar Sierpinski hexagons, okay? Same as the number of vertices. And if you measure each of those, each is exactly 1/3 the size of the entire Sierpinski hexagon. By the way, those of you who know something about fractals, do you see another important fractal in this picture? Look at the white region there. Right? The white region inside there is a Koch snowflake curve. Okay, there's a lot going on in this fractal. A couple more. Let me put down now five vertices, corners of a pentagon. I've changed the compression ratio now to 2.7. Again, that means if I'm here and I call red, I don't go half the distance to red, as I did in the case of the triangle. I don't compress by a factor of 3, as in the case of the hexagon. Rather, I move so that the resulting distance is 1 divided by 2.7 times the original distance. And when I play this chaos game, again, the same three surprises. Distinct geometric image, a fractal, the Sierpinski pentagon. And again, just by looking at this fractal, you can see that I used 5 vertices. And if you measure the size of each of these smaller pentagons, they're exactly 1 divided by 2.7 times the size of the original. So kind of interesting. One more, just because I said the triangle was the second most important fractal. Here is what I consider the most important planar fractal. Okay, I started with 8 vertices, compression ratio of 3, and when I roll the die, out comes another fractal, the so-called Sierpinski carpet. Okay, why is that the most important planar fractal? Well, it turns out that if you give me any curve in the plane, no matter how complicated, you know, it goes on and on, crosses all over the place, the most intricate planar curve that you have, that's one-dimensional, as long as it's compact and what we call connected, then that curve can be manipulated, right? Homeomorphically we call it, can be moved around so that it fits right inside the Sierpinski carpet. Any curve whatsoever, no matter how intricate, will fit inside the Sierpinski carpet. That's why that's topologically, at least, the most important planar fractal. Well, in the complement of the white region. Okay. For those of you who know the topologist sine curve, you know, remember the sine 1 over x, then it starts oscillating back and forth until it hits up against the y-axis. You see that in here? Take the topologist sine curve and don't make it curvilinear, make it rectilinear. So it goes up, over, down. And okay, where are we going? It's up, over, down, up, over, down, up, over, down, up, over, down. You can actually fit the topologist sine curve in. Put any curve whatsoever inside the Sierpinski carpet. It's what's called a universal plane continuum. And again, just by looking at this picture, you can read off the rules, right? You see 8 self-similar pieces, each 1/3 the size, and I started with exactly 8 vertices with compression ratio 3. Okay, everyone with me so far? All right, let me up the ante a little bit. Let me change the rules to include rotations. So let's start with 3 points, corners of a triangle. But when I call that red vertex, I first rotate toward it by 10 toward it, by a factor of 2, compressed toward it by 1/2, and then I'll rotate by 90 degrees around that red vertex. So if I'm here and I call red, I go halfway to red and then rotate by 90 degrees. But if I call green, I just go halfway to green, call blue, halfway to blue. And when I play this chaos game, again, same 3 surprises. And you see a fractal here, right? The green and the blue piece looks like it just squashed the whole thing by a factor of 2. But the tops piece here, the red piece, what did I do to get that? I squashed by a factor of 2 and then rotated by 90 degrees. Okay, well, one more. Let me change the rotation here to be 180 degrees. Now when I play this chaos game, another fractal, very different looking fractal, but do you see that you can go backwards? This fractal has 2 legs and a head. The legs are standing upright, 2 legs and a head, 2 legs and a head, but the head is rotated 180 degrees. It's standing on its head. So, again, with a keen eye for geometry, you can always read off the rules that you produced. Dan?
Clear where the three C points are.
Sometimes it is, like with the Sierpinski triangle, but when you're doing rotations, it's much harder to find. That's a lot more geometry to determine where they are. But I wasn't saying, you know, where they are. You can say there are three, and they have such and such a property. The psi omega, you'll see in a minute that it's kind of hard to determine that. Okay. All right. So, everyone with me so far? Okay, well, let's make sure. I know you weren't expecting a quiz, but here's a fractal quiz. You've got to tell me how I generated each of the following fractals. Okay, by that I mean you've got to tell me the number of vertices, the compression ratio, and which rotations, if any, that I used. Okay, so first fractal, the fractal icicle. How many vertices here? How many? I didn't hear. Two and four. That's what everyone says. They either say two or four. And then they settle on the right answer, which is somewhere in between. Ashley's three. I use three, and you'll see why. So look at that region there. I put a vertex way at the left-hand head, compressed it halfway to the left. Look at that region there, self-similar piece, compress it halfway to the right. And then the middle piece, what did I do there? Compress by a factor of two and rotate by 90 degrees. Now, notice there's a little overlap here. Okay, I did that so that not everybody would get an A on the quiz. You could have used four. You could have used four vertices. You could have put one here and one there as we did originally. And then you see two other self-similar pieces, one there and one there, that are now half the size of half the size before. So I could have used two vertices with a compression ratio of four, but where would I put them? You'd think I'd put them there, but no, there's going to be a rotation involved. So where I put that vertex is actually kind of crazy. So finding out where to put the vertex, if I were to use four vertices, is much more complicated. That's why I used three. Okay, another one. How many vertices? Now everyone's afraid to answer. This always happens. Three is right. Compression ratio of? Looks like two. Yeah, you don't know if it's 1.99 or 2.01, but it's a compression ratio of two, one half. That's about one half the size. Any rotations here? Yes. But how much? Well, there's actually several ways to do it, right? Notice we have three self-similar pieces here, two legs and a head, but the legs are standing on their head. They're standing upright, rotated 180 degrees. Both legs are rotated 180 degrees, and this one's rotated 100. So I use three vertices, okay, compression ratio of two, and a rotation of 180 degrees at each vertex. There are other ways of doing it because there are other rotations, but finding where to put the vertices there is, again, more complicated. One more. Mentioned this earlier. A piece of the Koch snowflake curve. How many vertices produce this? How many self-similar pieces? Four is right. Compression ratio of one third. Yeah, look at that piece right there. That's not half the size of the whole Koch curve. I compressed it by a factor of two to get there. I'd go halfway. I actually compress it by a factor of three to get this piece, and same with this piece. What about the other pieces? Compress by a factor of two, and then rotate by one angle in one direction, the other angle in the other direction. Okay, so compression ratio of three, four vertices, and two different rotations. One last one, just to make sure that no one passes the quiz. How many vertices here? to hear one. How many vertices? Three is right. Compression ratio of? Two is right. Any rotation? Yes, but how much? Actually, they're all rotated by 90 degrees. Three vertices, compression ratio of two, and all rotated by 90 degrees. Let me show you that. Let me take the fractal, compress it by a factor of two, and meanwhile rotate it by 90 degrees, and I get that self-similar piece right there. Let me do that again if it was too quick. Anything? Okay, compress by a factor of two and rotate, and I get this self-similar piece, and now you see two others that are rotated the same way. So three vertices, compression ratio of two, and rotation of 90 degrees. Okay, well, I haven't mentioned the applications of all of this, but one of the applications of this is actually in Hollywood. I had two students of mine in the 1990s go on to Hollywood to use these techniques to actually get involved in producing some of the Hollywood animations, so you can actually make movies that are very complicated. So once you produce one of these fractal images, you can string a bunch of them together and make a fractal movie. So how did I make this fractal movie? You've got to tell me how many vertices, compression ratio, and any rotations, and then what I did to move from frame to frame. How many vertices are here? Three is right. Compression ratio? Looks like two. Rotations? There's a particular piece. Okay, pretty clearly there's three vertices, compression ratio of two. Any rotation at that top vertex? No, it looks like you take the whole a fractal and just squash it halfway to the top. What about down here? Yeah, notice I'm rotating one certain angle in one direction and the same angle in the opposite direction. And what did I do to string these together? At each different frame, I just changed the rotation around these bottom two vertices by a different angle. Okay. So, by the way, notice that very little data went into making that movie. I had to tell the computer three vertices. I had to tell the computer compression ratio of two. I had to tell the computer to change the rotation by, I think, 10 degrees at each stage around the bottom vertices. And I had to tell the computer to roll the die 100,000 times for each chaos game. That's about 8 bits of data that made that movie. That's data compression. That's data compression in a big way, and that's one of the other applications of all of this. In any event, let me show you what we used to do back in Boston when I first started working with teachers. We'd run a chaos club where students would stay after school to use computers. It was in the inner city school, so they didn't have too much access to computers in those days. And, you know, we were doing all this stuff, and they kind of liked it. So one of the things that we'd do in the Chaos Club is I'd challenge the students to make a movie that was A, beautiful, and B, I couldn't figure out how they did it. I'll show you some of the award winners in a minute, but first, this is how they make the movie. Here's another applet that's on our website, FractAnimate. Okay. What you do to make a movie is you've got to tell the computer the starting frame, tell the computer the ending frame, and then how many frames to interpolate in between. For example, let's make a movie where I start with the let's do black and white, start with the Sierpinski triangle. Then at each frame, what I'll do is rotate by a different angle around that top vertex, say by 10 degrees at each stage, so much so that by the final frame, I rotate around that top vertex 360 degrees. So the final film, the final frame in this film will be same as it starts, right? If you go to the halfway to the top vertex, then rotate by 360 degrees, it's like not rotating at all. You get the Sierpinski triangle. So let's make this animation. Whoops, where is it? Oh, there it is. I want to rotate all the way around 360 degrees, so I need 336 frames plus a 37th to come back where I start. Okay, so let's do that. So you can see at each different stage, I'm rotating by 10 degrees around that top vertex. Think of doing this 20 years ago. Right? I'm rolling the die, I forget, 50,000 times at each frame. Okay, this is mathematics. It's really changed mathematics. There we go. So here's the movie. Boom. Look carefully at that. Watch that top piece. Yes, it's rotating 360 degrees around, but watch the top self-similar piece of the top self-similar piece. That's rotating twice as fast. That's rotating 720 degrees. You go to the next higher level, it's rotating twice as fast again. There's a lot going on here. And now again, think of how much data I had to throw into the computer to produce this little animation. Three vertices, compression ratio of 2, rotate by 10 degrees at each stage, roll the die 100,000 times, 50,000 times. Again, data compression. Here's another one. Here was this another movie that I really enjoyed, done by a student named Jason. He said to do the same thing, rotate 10 degrees around that top vertex, but meanwhile let that top vertex descend so that it's in a straight line with the other two vertices. So the final frame of Jason's movie was basically a straight line. So let's make this animation again. I'll rotate 10 degrees, so 37 frames as I go around. And now you can see that this top vertex, this top piece, is slowly settling down to be in line with the other two. So here was Jason's movie, Thud. He called it The Death of Sierpinski. Okay. So that's what I asked them to do, is make something that's creative, that's interesting. And in fact, here is the all-time, where is it? Oh, I can't find my movies, sorry. Where is it? Too many things up, that's the problem. Oh, there it is. Stupid. Okay, where's that? Here's, this was done by Lisa. Here's Lisa's greatest movie in the Chaos Club. How did Lisa make that movie? Okay. Don't worry about the end, she was just having fun. Okay. The colors mean something here. Look at that blue piece, right? That blue piece is a self-similar piece of the whole thing. Okay, it looks like Lisa put a vertex right up there in the upper left with a compression ratio that's not 2, not 3, not 4. It looks like it's about 5. And now look at the red piece. That's also a self-similar piece, right? If I take this fractal and just compress it by a little bit to lop off that far-out foot on the starfish, and then rotate it by some angle, it looks like I get the red piece. So it looks like Lisa used 2 vertices, 2 different compression ratios, and whatever, some rotations. So unfortunately, I've got everything open now. So let's see if that's what Lisa did. Let me go back to Fractalina. It looks like Lisa put down 1 vertex in the upper left with a compression ratio of, well, something that was pretty large. I think she put it in, I want to get rid of those vertices. So there's the first vertex. I think she had a compression ratio of about 5 there. 5. Okay. And now it looks like Lisa put in a second vertex right in the middle with a compression ratio that was small. What would a small compression ratio be? Yeah, one would be no compression, would just be rotation. So 1.05, 1.04. So it looks like she put in a compression ratio of, I forget what, 1.04. And some rotation, let's say 38 degrees. Okay. So, looks like that's what Lisa did. Let's see. That's what comes out. That's not right. What's wrong? You can see the paws of the starfish, but not the legs or the brains. Why are there no points in here? How would you get points in here? Well, you'd have to call this vertex. But if you were way out here and you called that green vertex, you inch toward it just a little bit. So you'd move toward it just a little bit and rotate. Call it again, inch toward it and rotate, inch toward it and rotate. You'd have to call that vertex over and over again in succession. But that's not going to happen, right? We basically got to die here. So we have to change the probability of rolling that vertex. Here comes some other mathematics. Here comes probability. So, wait a minute. There's no probability here. How do you think Lisa changed the probability of rolling that vertex? She just put a bunch of vertices right in the middle. She put a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. And now when you roll the die, you see the legs. You have a much better chance of rolling, coming closer to the middle. You see the legs, but not the brains. I think what Lisa actually did was put 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 points in the middle, and boom, there's one of the frames on that film. Kind of interesting. And now again, think of how much information goes into making this incredibly complicated movie. Two vertices, two compression ratios, right? Roll the die, 100,000 times at each stage, and change the rotation by 10 degrees. Again, eight numbers makes this thing. Again, data compression. Kind of interesting. Okay. Well, how are we doing on time? We still have time. Okay, well, there's one other thing here on the website that's called the Chaos Game. This is actually a game. Okay, what I've done is given you a target here in green. Doesn't matter where I put it. I've taken the Sierpinski triangle down to some level. I've given you a starting point here in red. And your goal is to get that starting point into the interior of this triangle. Okay, and how do you move that point? Well, you move it by the rules of the chaos game. For example, to get into the interior there, started here, I'd first go halfway to the left. So I move this point halfway to the left. Almost there, I'm on one of the vertices of the triangle. Go left again. Nope, still on one of the vertices of the triangle. Remember, I have to get into the interior. Go right, left. Oh, no, I'm still on the boundary of the triangle. I want to get into the interior. Pretty clearly, I've got to go up at least once, and maybe right, and left, and there. I've made it, finally. I get in there an 8. The intergalactic best score here is 4. I'm not very good at this. Anyone want to play me? There's some students here, right? You play me and beat me, I'll give you this computer. Come on up. Okay. Uh-oh, this guy looked pretty anxious to get up here, so let me change the level a little bit. Okay. Let's put it right there. Okay, your name is?
Matt.
Matt. Okay.
All right.
Oh, on the boundary. Close. Very good. Wow. Not so bad. Whoa. Wow. So Matt got in there in 9 rolls. That was 9. Were you standing on your head? Well, anyway, this is a fun game to play. So I would go left and up, and then left and up and left. Sorry, Matt. There's an algorithm for playing this game. Okay? There's an algorithm for getting into this triangle, no matter where it is, in exactly 5 moves. Okay? Figuring out the algorithm to get into this target, that's not so bad. You can do that in a few minutes. But figure out the algorithm to get into any of these targets, okay, and then being able to express, to enunciate that algorithm is what's tough. But that's what's all important in mathematics these days, figuring out the algorithm and then expressing it, being able to communicate it. Once you know the algorithm at this level, you can move to the hard level or to the master level. Okay. And for those of you who are students here, when you figure out the algorithm, I suggest you challenge your math teacher to play you at this level, because at this their age, they can't even see the target here. Can anybody? There's the target right there. Okay, but if you can see the target and know the algorithm, you can get in there in exactly 7 moves. Okay, good. Well, that's because I started where I did. Okay, because I started right here. If I had started someplace else, the number might have been different. For example, if I had started right in the middle here, it would have gone down by 2. Okay? But for starting at that point or any of the corners, it's exactly 7. And as you raise the number of triangles, it goes up each time by 1. I've actually technically never lost the computers, but I do this occasionally at NCTM meetings. Some people have been at NCTM meetings, and there I know a lot of teachers. So every once in a while, I'll have a friend in the audience. I remember one of a huge meeting. She came up, and she did the best score. Then I came up and accidentally hit the wrong button. Said, "Oh my God!" So I couldn't win. So I lost. Handed her the computer. Picked up another computer, put it up, and said, "Okay, let's keep going." Everyone said, "Oh my God, he lost it." So I've never technically lost my computer. Okay. Yeah, I'll show you the website for that a little bit later. So I mentioned that there's lots of applications of all of this. Let me show you where they come. Let me play a slightly different kind of chaos game, a little more advanced now. Before, when I played the chaos game, I started with a vertex, talked about a compression ratio and a rotation. Now what I'm going to do is tell you what to do with all points in a square. Those will be my rules. For example, here's one game. Here's rule number 1. Rule number 1 says first squish the square more from the bottom than the top, and then rotate it by some angle. Okay? So in line with what we did before, if I had a point someplace and I called number 1, say my point was here, what I'd do is I'd first squish that point and then rotate it, and I'd end up at the corresponding point on the image square. That's rule number 1. Here's rule number 2. Take the square and squish it a lot more, this time more from the sides than the top and bottom, and then rotate to the left. Okay, so again, if my point were here and I rolled number 2, I'd first squish and then rotate and end up at the corresponding point on now the image rectangle. That's rule number 2. Rule number 3 says first flip the square over its vertical axis, then again squish and rotate. Squish and now rotate right. So again, if I started here, I'd first flip and then squish and rotate and end up on the corresponding point on the image rectangle. And finally, rule number 4 says take the square and squish it almost completely, more from the sides than the top or bottom. Okay? So those are the 4 rules. So to summarize, here they are. Rule number one, squish, move from the bottom, rotate right a little bit. Rule number two, squish, rotate left. Rule number three, first flip, squish, rotate right. And rule number four, squish almost completely. Okay. So now let's go play the chaos game with these rules. Okay. And, well, here's some more mathematics. What are the rules governed here by? Linear algebra. Each of these rules is given by a matrix times a vector plus a translation vector. And like with Lisa's starfish, applied with some probability. So let's play the chaos game with those rules. And when we do, out comes another surprise. Out comes a fractal, not from geometry, but from nature. Okay, and that's one of the big reasons why these things went over so well in Hollywood. Because if you think of what's out there, especially in this area of Washington, everything is a fractal in nature. It's only the things that humans build that are Euclidean geometry, circles, spheres, rectangles, whatever. In geometry, in nature, the geometry is fractal geometry. So why did the fern come out here? How did we figure out the rules to produce this fern? Well, that's what we've been doing all afternoon, right? We've been just looking at the fractal and reading off the rules that we wrote down to create that fractal. For example, what if you apply rule number one to the fern? Remember, rule number one is squish more from the bottom and rotate a little bit to the right. If I apply that to the fractal, I get the top self-similar piece of the fractal. And what if I apply rule number two to the fern? Remember, take the fractal, squish, rotate to the left. When I do, I get the lower left frond of the fern. And what about rule number three? Remember, rule number three says first flip, and then squish and rotate right. And when I do that, gotta have some fun, you get the lower right frond of the fern. And now, what's missing? The stem, and what do you do to get that? Squish almost completely. Okay. So again, just by reading off the rules, just by looking at these objects with a keen eye for geometry and some linear algebra and probability, you can recreate virtually any fractal object in nature. Okay. And in fact, that's what my students were called to do in Hollywood. There was a time, oops, wrong one. I should get rid of that. There was a time where, in fact, a lot of this stuff, a lot of these chaos games were, were being used to produce the backgrounds in these sort of extraterrestrial movies. You know, way back in the 90s, they had these extraterrestrial movies with backgrounds that were very elaborate. How did they make them? They made them basically using data compression algorithms. Many of them involved using the chaos game. And there's different algorithms out there now, like wavelets that people use, but basically these are the simplest ones. And so my students actually did some of the things. That kind of made me jealous. Okay, here they are out in Hollywood, maybe winning Academy Awards, and I'm stuck back at home teaching calculus. So I decided to make my own, okay, incredibly moving movie. Okay, so this is it. When are the have the Academy Awards been announced yet, by the way? This year? Oh, they're already done for last year? Oh, I'm sure this is going to win it. I mean, this has got to win it. I mean, windy. Okay, I looked all over the Boston area for an appropriate actor, but I could only find the fern. So how did I make this incredibly gripping tragedy, not comedy? Ready? Here we go. Tragedy, not comedy. How am I making this fern blow in the wind? What am I doing here? You know, we could use those four rules. I think there were 28 or 29 numbers there to produce one image. What am I doing to make this fern blow in the wind? I'm just changing. Remember rule number one, squish in the bottom more and rotate? I'm just changing the rotation of that thing. I'm changing one number in that list of numbers that I gave you, and that produces the fern blowing in the wind. So you want to make up a movie of an extraterrestrial landscape? Well, no problem making the trees, making the cliffs, making the rocks, making the ferns. Wanted to blow in the wind? Yeah, change a number here or there. That was the point. It really made things a lot easier. In the old days, Disney would hire, 10,000 artists to sketch each frame. Now, as I always say to my students, now they hire one student who knows linear algebra, probability, geometry, okay, fractal geometry, and has a keen eye for all of that, and they can make all of these things, and that's what I had several students do. But in fact, if you go to Planet X, the ferns don't blow in the wind, right? What they actually do is droop. So how did I make this more realistic extraterrestrial fern? More going on than meets the eye here. You see the left side fronds are going up and down, but look at the sub-fronds over here. They're going up and down. And if you go to the sub-fronds of the sub-fronds, they're moving up and down. So there's a lot happening here in this movie, in this very realistic animation of what happens on Planet X. So what am I doing to make this animation here? Right, exactly. Remember rule number two was squish, rotate left, and that was a matrix plus a vector. I was just changing that translation vector up and down. Again, I was changing just one number to make that animation. So the point is that, you know, there's all kinds of mathematics in this area, right? Linear algebra, probability, geometry, that's very accessible to students at all levels, and is actually kind of beautiful. It also introduces them to stuff that, wait a minute, this is mathematics. This is beautiful. This is interesting. This is exciting. I said, no, this is mathematics. You gotta understand that. But in any event, this is what we do at our math field days, and they seem to really enjoy it. I just really think that we, those of us who are mathematicians, have to get out there and, in fact, communicate the beauty and accessibility of our field more. In any event, that'll end there. The website I used with all those applets is there, math.bu.edu. DICIS in caps. Anyway, maybe I'll stop there. Thanks.